News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. Yeah, so it is 2:23 p.m. Hey, Copper, I tell you what, I'm going to try and send you that audio link through from a different email address of mine. Let's see, maybe my Gmail's hanging it up. We'll try that, all right? So coming your way right now, coming to Copper. Everybody's listening to us do emails to each other, but got to get it to you so you can have it. Clip. All right, coming your way. All right, see if you get it. Okay, hey, folks, listen, D-Day is today. You know, it is, it's amazing to me to think that it's been 78 years, especially when I consider the fact that my grandfather marched across Europe first with the 82nd Airborne and then with the 18th Airborne Corps. And he was a figure in my life. And so I'm thinking these significant events that took place 78 years ago, they occurred, and there was someone who was instrumental in my own personal life who I have, you know, many, many memories of, who was, you know, contemporary to that time, who was doing those things, who was a part of the fight across Europe, if you will. Now, it's amazing, too, to also think about the number of Alabama connections we've got. Right in the Huntsville area alone, I mean, many of you are aware that the airport is named Carl T. Jones Airfield, that we've got Carl T. Jones Drive, Jones Valley in South Huntsville. If you're not familiar, the Jones family has, you know, been a mainstay within Huntsville since before it became Huntsville. But Carl T. Jones... and I've had a chance to get to know his family, several members of the family over the years, and most recently especially. But it's just so cool when you look at the impact that Carl T. Jones himself had on the Normandy invasion. Because he was an Alabama National Guardsman who was mobilized for duty first in the Aleutian Islands, because if you remember, the Japanese had invaded the Aleutian Islands up off the coast of Alaska. And as a result of his time there as the commanding officer for the U.S. troops that were stationed in the Aleutians, he literally helped put together an amphibious landing to fight the Japanese on one of the islands. At a later point, he got orders to fly to D.C. He was flown to D.C. not knowing what was going on, but was told when he got there that he was one of the only American officers, maybe the only American officer currently on active duty who had ever planned an amphibious operation, and he became a part of Eisenhower's staff and helped plan the Normandy invasion, Carl T. Jones of Huntsville. Talk about a connection. I mean, he literally was one of the only people in the entire inventory, if you will, of U.S. military personnel who had ever participated in, for that matter, had planned an amphibious landing. And he became an integral member of the planning on operations for Normandy. That's pretty significant. Other connections, though, I'll tell you. Other connections, if you look around the state of Alabama, you've got things like, for instance, one of the ships taking part in the bombardment of the Normandy coast on June 6th was the USS Tuscaloosa. It was a heavy cruiser that was named for the city, of course, the Alabama city, Tuscaloosa. According to the Encyclopedia of Alabama, the Tuscaloosa was the only New Orleans-class ship that made it through the war without sinking or sustaining severe damage. It was decommissioned in 1946 and later scrapped in the 50s, but its mast is right now at the Tuscaloosa Veterans Memorial Park, which you can see when you drive by. They got a great memorial park there in Tuscaloosa. And, yeah, the USS Tuscaloosa was part of the bombardment of the Normandy coastline for the invasion. How about this one? I did not know this. Maybe I'd heard it and forgotten it in the past. But in 1944, Major General Holland Smith, well, he was a native of Alabama. He made the cover of Time magazine. He was known as the father of amphibious warfare. He was the one who pushed for what became the Higgins boats, the ones that were used to go ashore on Normandy that had a boat, I mean, it had a ramp that would disembark troops off of. And it was his innovation that Eisenhower later said was the technical innovation that helped win the war. That's an Alabama native, Major General Holland Smith. And then, of course, this one, everybody knows about Jordan-Hare Stadium in Auburn, named in part for Ralph Shug Jordan, And Shug Jordan coached for Auburn for many, many years, was one of the men at Utah Beach. He took part in the invasion himself at 25 years old, and he was wounded in the shoulder by shrapnel. He never much talked about it. Didn't even use that as a speech to help fire up his players at halftime, it says in the article that I'm looking at. But Ralph Shug Jordan was one of the men of Utah Beach, Alabama man who came on back home and lived his life like so many of them did, nobody knowing, just by seeing him on a day-to-day basis, what kind of hell he had been through by going ashore at Normandy. You got other things happening, like the fact that, here's a piece, the 117th Air Wing, I pulled this off of there. The 117th Air Refueling Wing is based out of the Alabama Air National Guard in Birmingham. And just a couple years ago, they had a military cargo aircraft, a C-47, that was used, this same C-47 with the nickname, "That's All, Brother," painted on the nose, was used to drop paratroopers in the Normandy invasion. And it was flown by an Alabama National Guard crew. The six-man crew for "That's All, Brother," led by John Donaldson, a pilot from the 106th Observation Squadron of the Alabama National Guard back in the day. And that plane is still in existence, has been fully restored, and still flies for displays with an Alabama connection. Well, listen, coming back from the break here in a moment, we're going to take some time to talk about D-Day. A couple of things that I want to point out to you. And then a little speech from Ronald Reagan if we can get our audio clips together. Y'all hang tight. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. We'll be right back. News Talk 770 AM 92.5 FM WVNN. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid conservative, just plain right. So, you know, it is, like I said, June 6th. And June 6th, 1944 was often called the Day of Days. Now, my grandfather was a glider rider, first with the 82nd Airborne. You know, and being a paratrooper myself, I know that you're supposed to be all volunteers. It's a funny story in our family, though. My grandmother told me once, the granddaddy was in the 82nd Division, okay, because it wasn't always airborne. And she said she got a scratchy long-distance overseas call before, you know, he had gone off to some training event, and she could hear him in the background. He was yelling. Her name was Mary Frances, and she said, "Mary Frances, I'm in the 82nd Airborne Division now." And she said, "Mac, what's airborne?" He said, "I don't know. When I find out, I'll tell you." It's a heck of a thing because, you know, the airborne more often are thought of as the paratroopers, the ones who jump from the perfectly good airplane with a parachute and hope that silk opens up the way it's supposed to. But the other part of the airborne that we don't have anymore was what my grandfather did. The glider riders, they called them. The glider troops. And their badge, if you look at a set of airborne wings on a soldier's chest, it's a parachute with two wings coming out the side. And then if you look at a glider wings, you'll see the framing of a glider with the wings sticking out, superimposed over the larger wings of the airborne. Well, that was Granddaddy. And I asked him once, when I became a paratrooper myself and I began to sort of appreciate some things in more detail, I went to the Airborne Museum, and I saw one of those gliders. I mean, folks, it was like balsa wood. They were canvas on poles. And these things would hold a platoon of troops. Sometimes they would hold artillery pieces or jeeps or other, you know, smaller vehicles. And it was just amazing. They'd be towed behind one aircraft, have the cable let go, and they would glide in. And basically, they were going to land. There was no way around it because there's no engine. It's going down. And it's going down, hopefully, in a controlled descent. And it's going to land, hopefully, in a controlled manner, although not always. And I asked him one time, I said, "Granddaddy, what was it like being a glider rider?" And he just looked at me and said, "Boy, it was the most god-awful thing man ever invented." But he went on to be with the 82nd and then with the 18th Airborne Corps and marched across Europe and served for 31 years, I believe, retiring as a brigadier general. And, you know, I'm looking right now, June 6, 1944 was a day that put the best and the brightest in the position of having to do the worst and endure the worst. And the stories that came out of D-Day, you know, I've always tried to appreciate it. I've been a student of history, a student of military history especially, and I've always tried to appreciate it. I don't think I ever grasped the moment to the extent that I did when I saw the opening of Saving Private Ryan, because Steven Spielberg put everything he had into trying to bring accuracy and authenticity and terror to the screen of what it must have been like to go ashore at Normandy. Well, General Dwight D. Eisenhower wrote a letter, a one-pager, short letter that he had distributed to all the troops just before they embarked. And just to read you a brief quote of it, from Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force to the soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers-in-arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man-to-man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our great disposal the reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together in victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us beseech the blessings of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking. Dwight D. Eisenhower, Commander. Now, that by the way, that is a call to arms. That is leadership. That is literally saying, here's how it is. It's going to be hard, but by God, we're going to do it, and here's why. And I feel like that's missing to some degree these days. Not entirely. There are great leaders in the military even now. There are people who will do and go to the places that need to be done or need to have their action, that need to do the things that no one else wants to do. But there's something about the spirit of that day that we just cannot lose sight of. Now, Eisenhower's letter is historic. Eisenhower's letter I just read to you in its entirety, by the way. Eisenhower's letter is historic, but there was another one that is less known to me, but is apparently extremely powerful. Story on Fox News, just this morning. Title of it is, D-Day, 78 years later, how FDR's powerful prayer united Americans. Now, I was aware of Eisenhower's letter. I was not as aware of this one. That President Franklin D. Roosevelt got on the radio and called the nation to prayer on the eve of the invasion. And he did so in a way, he actually wrote the prayer himself, apparently with the help of his daughter. He put the words together, and they say that you could actually hear him rattling papers as he turned the pages when he read the prayer to the nation. It says in one part of this particular article that, I want to say, millions tuned in to listen. And it had an amazing effect. Leadership, when leadership leans towards certain directions and actually answers the call of its people, people will respond. Part of the prayer said, Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation this day, have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, to set free a suffering humanity. And he read this over the radio. And one particular man named Chris Long of Akron, Ohio, is the leader of what is now called the D-Day Prayer Project. His words were that FDR's prayer seemed to bring everybody together. And so the World War II Memorial Prayer Act was sponsored in 2014 by Senator Rob Portman and Representative Bill Johnson, both of Ohio. And it was passed unanimously in the Senate in 2014. Overwhelming support, bipartisan support in the House 2 weeks later. President Obama signed it into law, but no tax dollars have ever been assigned to it. It's going to be funded independently. But there's a plan right now for a permanent memorial featuring brass plates engraved with the prayer mounted on a granite base near the World War II Memorial on the Washington Mall. And it says in this article that the nation awoke on June 6 of 1944 to learn that its heroic youth had crawled from the sea, fell from the sky overnight in an effort to wrest an enslaved Europe from Hitler's clutches, and that Roosevelt helped give some steel to the frightened mothers and fathers and a worried but determined nation because of the shocking human cost they were about to see. Literally, by the time the battle for Normandy was won, 29,000 American troops were dead and more than 100,000 were wounded. But on the very first day, 4,400 died the very first day of the invasion. It was a price that was paid that was so incredibly steep. And that, by the way, is just the Americans. That's not counting the other Allied forces or, for that matter, the Germans. 4,400 Americans killed on D-Day alone in one day as they sought to take back freedom from tyranny. And it says that with regards to FDR's prayer, that Americans by the millions instinctively responded to the news by flooding into their churches and synagogues. And there are several who now cite FDR's faith-filled entreaties on that day, it says in this article, as the resulting response of being the largest mass prayer event in human history. I mean, this is an amazing time. We can't get to the point that we forget what happened 78 years ago today. Next year, 79, the year after that, 80, and I hope that we never, ever forget. And if you ever have a chance, and I haven't yet, but if you ever have a chance to go over to Normandy and to see the rows upon rows upon rows of gravesites at the American cemetery there, I'm pretty sure it will humble you into the recognition that what happened was significant and still bears significance even to this day. All right, Copper, go ahead and move us to a break. When we come back from this, folks, one of my favorite parts of that entire story, being a Ranger myself, is what 2nd Ranger Battalion did when they climbed the cliffs of Pont de Hoc and what Ronald Reagan had to say about that a few years later. We'll talk about it when I get back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right. D-Day, 78 years later. Y'all stay tuned. News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right. Saving the world one soundbite at a time, I like to say. Hey, sitting here in the studio, coming up after the top of the hour, my friend, State Representative Mac Butler. He carries a title because he's been a state representative before, but he also just won the election. But now his election is being challenged. So in a little while, we're going to talk to him about that, among other things that are happening in the world of Alabama politics. But right now, let me do this. I want to finish up this time of talking about D-Day and honor this. I mean, on behalf of my own grandfather and the number of others who came home from that day, there were so many that didn't. And like I said a moment ago, 4,400 Americans, just Americans alone, died on the first day of the D-Day invasion. Can you imagine? I mean, that exceeds years of Afghanistan and Iraq combined. That's an amazing number when you stop and think about it. Well, one of the stories from that particular day, you know, and if you're not familiar with it, just understand this. As a Ranger myself, there were certain things you were required to memorize. You had to memorize the Ranger Creed. You had to memorize certain sections of Ranger history. You had to know the legacy of the fighting force that you were being, you know, trained to be a part of. And one of those is the Rangers of 2nd Ranger Battalion, who on D-Day climbed the cliffs at Pont de Hoc. There was this huge, sometimes 100-foot-tall cliffs on an escarpment that stuck out right between Omaha and Utah beaches, Pont de Hoc. And Pont de Hoc literally was the place where there were German guns emplaced along the top, six of them, I believe, huge artillery batteries that were designed to basically defend the coastline and provide bombardment capability to the Germans. It was decided early on that the Rangers would be the one to climb those cliffs. Now, the Germans, I'm looking at a piece I pulled off of armyhistory.org, and the Germans literally says, the Germans literally thought that it was inaccessible, that there was no way that anybody was going to come up those cliffs. The Americans, however, considered it to be an accessible assault point. They reasoned that they could have a well-trained fighting force get up those cliffs using ropes and ladders. Think about it. Ropes and ladders. 100 feet of cliff climbing, under fire, after coming ashore for an hour in a landing craft. General Omar Bradley, he wrote, when he assigned this to Lieutenant Colonel Rutter, he said, "No soldier in my command has ever been wished a more difficult task than that which befell the 34-year-old commander of the Ranger Force." 34 years old. There was one other, an intel officer who worked for Rear Admiral John Hall, who said that three old men with brooms could keep the Rangers from climbing that cliff. It was going to be so hard. Well, listen, on D-Day, Rutter and his force with 2nd Ranger Battalion, made up of 225 soldiers initially, along with the 5th Ranger Battalion in support, went on to carry out that mission. And it did not go as planned. Like everything else on D-Day, with paratroopers being dropped miles off the off their landing zones, and with, you know, troops hitting the wrong beaches, and with everything going crazy, the same would be true of the Rangers. At one point, literally, as they're coming ashore, spending an hour getting seasick in their landing craft, they literally had they had several of their landing craft that got swamped. They lost people not from enemy contact, but from literally having boats capsize. 22 soldiers in one boat went down on their way to the shore. And then at one point, they realized that while H hour for climbing the cliffs was set to be at 0630, by 0630, they weren't even at the right place. They were 3 miles off. The waters were so choppy and the current so strong, their boats had been moved 3 miles downshore, and they had to come back along the shoreline to get to their objective. When they finally reached it at 0710, for over 40 minutes, the Germans had been recouping from a bombardment that had already ended. And the delay had given the Germans plenty of time then to recuperate and reposition their defenses, and the Rangers hit the beach, but at that point, they were almost down half of their fighting force. They came under heavy fire as they began to fire their rocket-propelled rope lines up onto the cliffs. It says many of the ropes caught hold, but many of them were cut, and many of them also didn't hold, making it very difficult and even more likely that they were going to face issues. The wet ropes were slippery. The soldiers were weighed down by damp uniforms and mud clinging to their clothes and boots and equipment. German bullets and potato masher grenades were raining down from above, but the Rangers continued to climb. Well, this was a heroic effort, and when they got to the top, they did everything they were supposed to do. But getting there itself was a feat of human endurance like nothing else. Well, a few years ago, I say a few years ago, he's been gone for a while now, but President Ronald Reagan went to Pont de Hoc and gave a speech right in front of the Ranger Memorial with the cliff sides right behind him. Copper, you got clip one ready. Go ahead and highlight it for me on the board if you're good. What I'd like to do is end this segment with the words of President Ronald Reagan as he talks about the Rangers climbing Pont de Hoc. Copper, go ahead and play it.
Cannon. At dawn on the morning of the 6th of June, 1944, 225 Rangers jumped off the British landing craft and ran to the bottom of these cliffs. Their mission was one of the most difficult and daring of the invasion: to climb these sheer and desolate cliffs and take out the enemy guns. The Allies had been told that some of the mightiest of these guns were here, and they would be trained on the beaches to stop the Allied advance. The Rangers looked up and saw the enemy soldiers, the edge of the cliffs, shooting down at them with machine guns and throwing grenades, and the American Rangers began to climb. They shot rope ladders over the face of these cliffs and began to pull themselves up. When one Ranger fell, another would take his place. When one rope was cut, a Ranger would grab another and begin his climb again. They climbed, shot back, and held their footing. Soon, one by one, the Rangers pulled themselves over the top, and in seizing the firm land at the top of these cliffs, they began to seize back the continent of Europe. 225 came here. After 2 days of fighting, only 90 could still bear arms. Behind me is a memorial that symbolizes the Ranger daggers that were thrust into the top of these cliffs. And before me are the men who put them there. These are the boys of Puente Hope. These are the men who took the cliffs. These are the champions who helped free a continent. And these are the heroes who helped end a war.
Well, let it sink in. Let it sink in. June 6, 1944, 78 years today. 4,400 men gave their lives to take back the world. Don't let it ever become a thing that we forget. Don't let it ever become that thing that's just relegated to the pages of a dusty book. It needs to be remembered. It needs to be treasured. And hopefully it'll never be repeated. All right, folks, we're going to switch gears when I get back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, coming up. Election machinations. We'll talk about it with my friend, State Representative Mac Butler. Y'all stay tuned. We'll be right back.